as far as I see it, I believe we have an epidemic of adults, myself included, that are emotionally immature in one and sometimes multiple ways. Again, all because of the modeling, the conditioning, what we were taught, what we were not taught. However, a lot of us are ill-equipped, and we're trying to very well intentionally shape these future generations. And I just don't think we are going about it the fully right way, because we have to do the work first ourselves before we can really impart change.
And no matter where you are in the world, I want to genuinely thank you for taking the time to listen to my Run Your Life podcast series. The whole idea behind this podcast is to share stories from the world of education and beyond of people who are striving to make a difference in the world through their work. The inspiring guests that I have had on my show have truly done the tough inner work needed to deepen learning about themselves in order to be able to give back to the world in ways that are truly making a difference. Whether it be through professional sports, the arts, research, education, or through the field of mental health and wellness, each of my guests have committed themselves to pursuing mastery of their own craft in order to motivate others to do the same. It is clear that my guests have placed great emphasis on developing their own inner skills in order to not only be their best, but to build the resilience and grit needed to pursue excellence in their chosen field. I'm super grateful today to have Dr. Nicole LaPera, the holistic psychologist, on my show. For those of you who are not familiar with Nicole's work, you can easily find her by checking out her website at yourholisticpsychologist.com. Nicole has developed a massive following of over 2.4 million people on Instagram, and her following continues to grow each day because it is clear that the world needs her work. I think that people are drawn to her work not only because of her honest and authentic way of sharing her own journey of ups and downs and the challenges that she has had to overcome in her life, but also because of the very applicable and practical self-healing strategies that she shares on a regular basis on her YouTube channel. Extraordinary thinkers and doers take action and have a very strong sense of what it is they believe in. And in Nicole's case, she is able to clearly articulate the steps and strategies needed for people to connect more deeply to their own consciousness in order to live a more fulfilled and purposeful life. Her work is exactly what the world needs right now and into the future. I'd like to sincerely thank Nicole for taking the time out of her busy schedule to speak with me in this episode. She firmly believes that teachers are such an important part of a student's life and that they hold the key to helping young people feel valued and cared for and empowered to build the necessary skills to contribute to the world in their own unique ways based on the talents that they possess. Without further ado, my episode with the inspiring Dr. Nicole LaPera. Okay, Nicole, it's great to have you on the show, and I really do appreciate your time. You know, you have such an extensive body of work, and one of the things that I just want to say is I really do appreciate your time, and I think that the work that you're doing is not only important for adults, but it's important for adults who teach children. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show. So again, thank you.
Of course, Andy. Thank you so much for having a chat with me, allowing me to connect with your community. And I very much am very passionate about the population, the teaching world that your main community is based around, because they have so much impact And I think in a lot of ways, and I think we're going to dive into this, they are ill-equipped, just as many of us therapists. The mental health world, I believe, is largely ill-equipped. So hopefully this conversation can shed some light on a direction that I think really impactful profession like teachers need to be moving in.
So the first thing just to start is, you know, it's very tough to disconnect from who we are professionally. And I just wanted to ask you, when you think of yourself as a partner and a friend, and just as a person, how have you been doing through the crazy COVID-19 public health crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's presented, as it has for a lot of us, some level of challenges. I'm very grateful that I haven't had a suffer the more extreme challenges that I know that a lot of us have. So in terms of my professional world, it looks very similar. My personal world, nothing really changed. I work from home. I work with my partner. So on a day-to-day, all the systems are firing as usual, if you will. I think, though, like a lot of us, something like the quarantine and COVID and all of these unusual times bring up deeper stuff. So for me, you know, it's kind of those older programs, the how do I navigate time when it's, for me, I'm someone who has been very successful with structuring my time, being the busy person, right? Keeping myself, if you will, distracted. So when life has come to a halt, as it has, while I do have the things to be distracted by, I think a lot of us are, or at least I'll speak for myself, some things of the deeper stuff is coming up. So I have my moments where it is challenging and, you know, trying to just give space to all of the deeper feelings, as I urge us all to do during these interesting times.
Yeah, I had a guest on this show. She's a crisis management and risk expert based in Australia. And she was talking about that idea that right now there's a lot of people and a lot of research around the fact that people are dreaming a lot more than they did before during this public health crisis. So maybe it's relived trauma, maybe it's just things they're working through, but that people are reporting dreaming a lot more. And maybe that's anxiety based, who knows, but have you heard that, and do you see that happening as well in your profession?
That's interesting. I haven't heard it translating to dream life. Probably, I think, Andy, just because dreams aren't necessarily a frequently visited topic. So it might be, and just not being talked about. I'm trying to think if I've had an increase myself. I don't think so much. I know what comes up is because there's a lot of fear, very understandably, you know, around the uncertainty, the health risk that a lot of us are really up against. What is coming up for a lot of us is that insecurity of the trauma response. I think that a lot of us have endured based on past experiences. So I say that to say, you know, in our dreams that can be reflected of these, you know, earlier traumatic memories that are in a sense being exacerbated now. However, you'll also hear me talk about what I define as a more expanded view of trauma. So I know historically we do think of, oh, now nightmares are coming up at night. There's a lot of ways, though, in our daily life, in our waking life, that if we are feeling triggered in terms of safety, if we're feeling not safe, as a lot of us are not feeling right now, that we could be in that conditioning around those trauma responses in daylight as well. So not just in our dreams. And I talk about that because I'm someone who never checked the boxes of the trauma as we typically think it. Right? I didn't have the big, bad, scary event that happened. I therefore didn't have the memories of it, yet I had a lot of ways that I was struggling. So whenever we have conversations like this, I'm always going to illustrate all of the other ways I think that we can be challenged. So some of us might be seeing that in our dream life, and a lot more of us might be just living those patterns from those earlier traumas that we never really fully processed or coped with as successfully.
And that's at a subconscious level, these subconscious habitual thought patterns that aren't serving us. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about before diving deeper is just for you to give us a glimpse into early days and what family life was like. And in particular, what strengths do you think you had developed early on that served you throughout your journey and kind of figuring yourself out and ultimately getting into the work that you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So from my early life, I'm someone who, a human who would always have described themselves as anxious. I was a little girl, you know, hiding under tables, really afraid of the world. So that was my kind of emotional climate for as long as I can remember. And the family system that I was born into, you'll always hear me describe it as an enmeshed or a codependent. So a system that lacked boundaries. And stress, right, was fear, was really the major climate in my whole household, meaning we all kind of rode the similar roller coaster. A family mantra that I always am referring to, because it really encapsulates this experience, is it's always something. And now something could be, right, the people didn't come to pick up the trash on the day they were supposed to. And something could be my mom, who was also chronically ill for my life, is having a health issue, right? So it really did span. But when I say that always something, the whole family would go into a stress response until that something was resolved. And then we would go back to baseline. So this experience really imprinted me. And I do believe it set me up to be the therapist that I would eventually become. Because a couple things happen when you grow up in a system like I did. So while I say we were stressed out a lot, my mother was very emotionally distant. She wasn't close, really connected to me, and was really incapacitated herself in terms of her own emotional world, which meant that for me, you know, showing up to help me regulate as an infant, as mothers need to do, infants can't regulate their bodies, can't regulate their emotions. My mom was really had no capacity to do that. So I was left largely alone and overwhelmed in my feelings. But what this set up for me as a human and then as a professional, or how this would translate, I got really good at a couple things. I got really good at dissociating, or I would come to find that's what I did. I had no idea until I was in my probably nearing my 30s that I would actually have said, oh, I was dissociated. Mm-hmm. So from that overwhelm, I became so dissociated from my own feelings, detached from them. And what I would focus most of my attention on was other people around me. How were they feeling? How were they doing? How can I show up to be good or be what they
need? Like the caregiver.
The caregiver, right? Yeah. I became the people pleaser that a lot of us do, right? So I became, I almost kind of limited my own contact with my emotional world in service of others, which fast forward after a lot of schooling, what did I become? Right? A therapist who is focused right on, and that's fine. Not everyone who's in the therapy profession, right, does worries about others to their detriment, but I did. In all of my relationships, I came to find, you know, as I was reaching mid, you know, my 20s, my 30s, I was so focused on everyone else that I was disconnected from my physical body and all of its needs. I was disconnected from my emotions. All I knew, my only vocabulary was still around stress. I wasn't good at dealing with it, yet I had all of the experience of it and in my relationships. Right? So I saw all of this patterning that I was carrying in my personal life as well, that while there were some strengths, right, I was very attuned to others. I could connect and be very present with them and, you know, show up for them the way they needed me to. But I came to find a large absence, which is around me and myself. So my healing really began from what on the one hand could have been, right, the strengths that set me up to go in this profession of helping, of healing. But really it began my healing journey back to myself. Before then, I could show up really successfully in these other relationships.
So do you think that you were burying feelings? Was it a conscious attempt to bury feelings, or you were so concerned with other people and being of value to other people and being the caregiver and being there for them that you just didn't recognize your own emotions?
A little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I think when I was very young, I had feelings that were completely overwhelming. So like I was describing earlier, we are born in a complete state of dependency. Human beings quite literally need another caregiver to meet our physical needs, right? And then we have this whole emotional self that is very complicated as human, right? And a spiritual self. So we are in the state of dependency. So as these big feelings, big adult feelings were happening in my family around me, my mother, right, because she wasn't able to regulate herself, wasn't able to help me regulate. So in that moment, right, my mind did what all of our minds do, right? The brain is the organ. The mind is all the functions of them, to keep it really simple, right? It coped. It's very adaptive. It found a way to keep moving forward, to keep getting my little infant needs met, which at that time was disconnecting from my physical self. So it started where like I had no other choice. And then I got positive feedback, right? I got praised in a sense when I showed up, right? When I made mom happy, you know, mom smiles and mom's loving of me, and that's reinforcing. So then it became, I got so focused on feeling good that way, right? That fed me in some way that allowed me to feel good enough about myself that it didn't matter to me that I was ignoring this other part of myself that was built. So, right. And then you live that pattern, you repeat that quite literally like Groundhog's Day, day in and day out in all of my relationships for 30 some odd years. And then it's like, I don't know where the beginning and where the end of me is. I've lost myself entirely.
Right. And I think I heard an interview, or maybe you mentioned, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel as though I heard you talk about you were an athlete and you played sport. So was that, because for me growing up in the environment I did in a very dysfunctional, family, I sought refuge and escape in sport. And I'm so grateful to this day for having found sport, because that's what gave me a sense of belonging, you know. But in your case, can you describe the role of physical activity in sport and what it played in your life at that time?
Yeah. So for me, very early on, I learned two things I was really good at. Athletes, like athletics. So for me, softball was what I was very good at, and academics. And when I would bring home that, it started with academics first, I would bring home my good report card, right? And I would get rewarded quick. I would get money. You know, I would get a gift. You know, my parents would reward good grades.
Yeah.
I also started to notice. So my mom in particular had me involved in everything when I was a young kid, from sports to art to dance. I tried all the things. Yes. Right. And so it became clear to me that I was better at athletics. I liked to dance, I believe, but I wasn't getting the feedback. I wasn't, you know, the best on stage. I wasn't getting the trophies like I was getting in softball in particular. Something else I noticed, my parents are really into athletics and they like it, right? So they liked me playing softball. And I also noticed that my mother, who had physical, you know, chronic illness, like she had a lot of pains, aches, similar to fibromyalgia, you know, like incapacitated in bed. What would get my mom out of bed was coming to watch me play softball, right? So now I had this whole, you know, all of these positive feelings, right? I had this present mother who's now, you know, on the side of my sporting, you know, field watching me, as opposed to being in bed where she spent some other, you know, most of her time. So that felt good. She's praising me. So before I knew it, it was deeper than I feel good because I'm getting the awards. It was, I feel good because my mom's present. My mom's seeing me. I'm as connected to my mom as I've ever been. So before I know it, that was case enough for me to continue to cultivate both of those areas. So of course I went to the highest schooling that you can. I had my PhD. Yes, I needed my PhD to be able to practice as well, but I'm sure some of it was me trying to just perform, right? Continue to get those A's.
Yeah.
Similar with softball. I played softball up through college, and actually making the decision to stop playing softball my junior year of college. Looking back on this now, I see that as such a notable decision for me, because it was the first time I made a decision for me, separate from what I imagine my parents would want. But that took me until I was, 23, 22 years old. So I was still showing up as the athlete.
Yeah. To pursue the academic route, like that's what you were emotionally invested in at that point. Is that why you stopped softball?
No, I stopped liking it. I stopped enjoying myself. And so that's interesting, because I think what started to happen is that internal drive, the part of me that loved the game, was being outweighed by all the other things that I didn't love about it. And I remember internally, I really battled with myself for probably about 6 months before I told my parents that I was considering not wanting to play anymore. Outwardly, I'm sure it was pretty evident that I wasn't happy playing. The commitment in Division I in college age is intense. So if that's not there, you know, it takes a toll. But it took me about 6 months, probably, Andy, to come into internal terms with I'm not happy before I could even tell my parents that I was. And they were very supportive of that at the time. You know, by all means, they were, you know, let me make that choice and honored it. But I just illustrate that because those, like I was saying, when you asked me about COVID, right? And another byproduct and another place I put my anxiety was into those channels, right? Into school. Once you get up to higher education, you always have homework and papers to be, right? Focus for my attention. Same thing with sports, focus for my attention. So the positive side of my anxiety for me is I learned how to harness it, how to motivate, how to be productive. However, there is a too much in that direction as well. So when things came crashing to a halt, when I stopped playing softball was, you know, when for me, this, my anxiety notched up a bit more because my time wasn't as filled. I wasn't getting that validation anymore to feel good about myself. So I started to find that as I was leaving college, you know, my first couple of years out on my own, I started to hit a low in terms of mood, anxiety. It started to get, that's when I really entered a really kind of dark period in my 20s, in my personal life. And I attribute it to not having that focal point and having all the time and the space for my feelings that I hadn't been tending to all along to come up to the surface and to overwhelm me yet again.
Yeah. And your story, you know, I've heard your type of story with when people choose to stop playing sport to pursue something else. And it is that, how do you fill the time? And then you're on your own and you have to figure all of this out, you know? And that's one of the, to segue into like school and education. And that's what I want to ask you is like all of your work, the holistic psychologist, everything that you've learned about yourself, I think one of the things that I think is so important about your work and why people are drawn to it is that they hear your genuine and authentic story and your willingness to be vulnerable and to share your story of what you went through, but what you still go through and what you recognize within yourself. And in knowing what you now know, which is going to change as you learn more about yourself and your work, but I want to ask you, if you were suddenly transported into the role of a school director or a superintendent, and you are in charge of a group of schools. A lot of schools, we talked about this before we recorded, a lot of schools say they prioritize social and emotional learning, and they recognize that it's critical to student growth and development. But really what takes center stage is testing, math, literacy, more data at the expense of social and emotional learning. So if you were a superintendent, what are two or three things that you would do to emphasize and prioritize psychological safety and social and emotional wellness in schools? What are the very first things that you would do?
Yeah, 100%. I think our school system is the major system that most of us come through that really overemphasizes to our detriment as humans, the thinking mind. So I think first and foremost, we have to turn down the volume on all mental thinking, testing, right? I use my mind to solve problems, focus in school period. It's way too much. Yes, we are gifted with all of the cognitive faculties of the mind, you know, that our human brain allows us to have, which is incredible. However, it's completely overemphasized and over relied on. So we have adult humans who are trying to think our way through life, to our own detriment. We're totally disconnected from what I believe to be our actual guidance system, which is our intuition, our deeper inner sense of knowing. Quite simply, Andy, the more time we're in our mind, the less time we're in our bodies and in our physical senses and able to tune in to those pings, that intuition. So in terms of school system, right, we really need to move, which is what my passion is in terms of the mental wellness field, to a more holistic model. So one that's not just separating the brain, right? So in my field, right, it's tinkering the mind to fix, you know, whatever the symptom is. That doesn't work because we're a mind, body, and a soul. In school, right, it's not just think our way through problems. I think we need to deconstruct and go back and start to teach in a more holistic way, teaching children or people of all, humans of all ages that, as far as I see it, you know, we are a mind, a body, a soul. There's emotions. There's other tools that we need to be connected with. And it starts with learning the ways, whether it's through movement or through consciousness or mindfulness-based approaches, right? Where I learn how to be consciously present out of my mind, in my body. I believe that's where the impact and change and the paradigm shift that I think needs to mirror what I'm hoping is happening in the mental wellness field, in the school system in general.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I like to stress with teachers when I run workshops is if you get the social and emotional right, that's going to lead to psychological safety, which will then allow students an entry point into their own learning in a safe way, where each student can find that entry point and understand what that entry point is. And I think that's a key, you know, the key building blocks to creating a meaningful program. And again, it's always emphasized social and emotional learning. So how do you teach the mind-body connection, you know, you said through movement at such a young age? How do you scale it back? And what are the first things that you would have teachers do with their students?
Yeah, any moment that we can urge, teach, cultivate presence, consciousness, goes a long way. So I say movement because especially with children, they're moving generally. So what that looks like is when they're moving and they're playing a game, right? Being present with them in the physical, you know, experience of playing a game. So listeners might be like, well, that's what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. It like really, is that what you're doing? Because I know I've played many games with children and my mind is a million miles away. I'm not actually present. So what that means, right, is engaging that child or whomever age that person is in presence, like being physically there with the game, you know, being in the body, asking the kid how they're feeling moving around today versus yesterday, right? So engaging the present moment goes, and it sounds so simple. I'm sure people listening are like, well, it's not as easy. And this goes back to what you and I were chatting a bit about when we began, right? There's tools, right? And we all love this. And I'm not a parent. So I don't know, have the lived experience of being a parent, but I get this question a lot from parents and I can extend that to educators, right? Well, what do I do? How do I teach kids tools? That's one conversation. How do I practically teach a kid how to do something different? But in my opinion, Andy, that question is answered first by, well, how do I do different in this moment as the parent, as the educator, right? How do I actually embody what I'm trying to teach before I, you know, do as I say, not as I do? Well, children are going to be more absorbing of what they're witnessing. So it's not as easy as just acquiring the toolkit so that you're parroting to the child how to be present in that moment, right? What I'm suggesting, it's about learning how to embody presence in that moment so that you're actually there with the kid. And that's what I mean when I say those small conscious moments, but describing it, right? There's a lot of process involved, but it goes an incredibly long way because that will help cultivate that reconnection to that child. So whether or not that then is child becomes an adult who's connected to their physical needs, right? So they're able to treat their body in a different way than maybe they would have if they were disconnected. Maybe it becomes an adult who understands their emotional world. As far as I see it, I believe we have an epidemic of adults, myself included, that are emotionally immature in one and sometimes multiple ways. Again, all because of the modeling, the conditioning, what we were taught, what we were not taught. However, a lot of us are ill-equipped and we're trying to very well intentionally shape these future generations. And I just don't think we are going about it the fully right way because we have to do the work first ourselves before we can really impart change.
Yeah, I love that. And what you're saying, I think, is that idea that everybody has experienced some form of trauma. And a lot of people think that, you know, the big T, the big trauma, if you experience big trauma, then you might have issues that you have to deal with throughout life. But little trauma comes in many different forms. And little trauma, and I've heard you say this many times, is like not being seen, not being valued, not being respected. And to a young person, you know, not feeling valued can cause many problems. And I wanted to mention Bryan Stevenson. Have you heard of Bryan Stevenson? He's a lawyer, a civil rights lawyer in Alabama. He did a TED talk viewed 6.5 million times called "We Need to Talk About an Injustice." And his movie just came out called Just Mercy. And it's amazing. He represents
Have
people.
Have not. Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's amazing. He represents people on death row and he, has freed many people on death row that have been wrongly accused. And he did this amazing TED talk. And what he said at the start is, if you are a teacher, your words can have meaning, But if you are a compassionate teacher, your words can have so much more impact and meaning. And what he's saying there is that, you know, compassion goes a long way. And that's what you started to talk about just before I started saying this, is that idea that inner work is needed by all adults. So teachers who are responsible for trying to foster and embed social and emotional learning into a curriculum, they need to do the work themselves first, right? So what do you suggest, or what insight do you have for teachers who can begin doing some inner work to know their triggers and to ultimately be more present with their students to make the connections you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the only, I just want to offer too, because I'm sure teachers out there are listening, you know, and teaching, and maybe, oh shoot, I haven't done the work yet, right? Starting the work is great. We don't have to quit our job and go do the work, right? Because something you'll also hear me talk about often, Andy, is there's no end. There's no final goalpost where I kick the field goal and it's done. So work is an ongoing evolution. So anyone who's listening and maybe is teaching and hasn't started the work yet, you know, I always say this, right? The next moment is another perfectly good moment to make a different choice, and you can begin the journey. So that's my very long way of saying it's about just engaging in healing. So you beautifully answered it by observing the self, by learning the self, by learning first and foremost how to be conscious, right? Observing throughout your day. Are you one of those people that are living on that autopilot that I'm sure we've all heard talked about? I know I was, right? Do I wake up? Do I do the same thing day in and day out? You know, we're very habitual. A lot of us have the same behavioral habits. A lot of us have the same thoughts that we get stuck in, feel the same way day in and day out, right? So observing that and learning how to show up consciously, right? Create new change, make new choices. That comes when we're conscious. So becoming conscious, you know, learning how to show up and be present in each moment so that we can begin to make new choices in the areas that we want to change is a great first step. You also talked about another thing comes up with children. Like I said, I don't have them, but I have nieces and nephews and I've been around children. One of the most challenging aspects in navigating children is the fact that inside we too have an inner child. We too are carrying all of the wounding based on our past experiences. So just like when you're quote unquote triggered by your partner who's your age, we can be triggered by something that a child is experiencing or happening in the dynamic between a child. So that's often what the case is, whether you're a parent or a teacher or just a caregiver of children, right? Your inner child is being activated in the same moment as theirs. So now you have more or less two children trying to navigate a really emotionally difficult moment. And that's okay. It's okay that if you're the adult, you know, in age numbers in this equation, a lot of us need to learn some new tools. So observing yourself, the triggers that are going to come up, right? The things that are challenging for you in your relationship with your students are probably going to be quite similar to the things that are challenging. While it might be a six-year-old, right, that's initiating in this moment, right? That six-year-old might be pinging that little I'm not good enough narrative that you entertain all the time, right? That same narrative that your partner triggers, you know, when he or she or they do something outside, right? So I say that to illustrate, observe yourself, observe the things that make you upset, whatever upset is, there's patterns there, there's learning there. And that's where the deeper work can happen. You can understand yourself. And then over time, you can cultivate a new response in that moment, right? So instead of yelling maybe at the child or the partner or, you know, detaching from the child or the partner, you know, oh, I can't talk to you right now, Johnny, you know, learning how to show up in a difficult moment in a new way. And like I said, we are so rich with ourselves day in and day out. So all you have to do is watch yourself. You're going to see these moments of challenge. And like I said, they all tell a story. They tell a story typically based on the experiences that we've had at a time where we weren't equipped to deal with them. Now we are, but now we have to consciously, intentionally begin to tell a new story.
Yeah, that idea of personal narrative. And again, a lot of people's personal narratives are created on their subconscious ways of thinking. Right. So they create these narratives that absolutely do not serve them well. And it's just this cycle of this personal narrative that really constricts them. It's very constricting. So a couple things there is, like you're saying, yeah, be conscious, practice consciousness, understand when you're in a loop of thinking that doesn't serve you well. But when you know you're triggered, it's about creating space, right? Mm-hmm. To not have a knee-jerk reaction, but yes, to create space to respond in a way that is more empowering to yourself and others. So talk about ways that you share with your clients, that teachers might share with their students, that teachers might work on themselves, about how to create more space in the moment when you recognize you're triggered.
Absolutely. Love that question. That's exactly what it is. Because just to clarify, those old reactions don't poof magically go away, right? So it is learning how to create and stand in that space while, right, that older mindset is, you know, that older narrative is being triggered or activated. And maybe I'm feeling compelled to do that old thing. It's standing in that space while that is happening almost beneath the surface and beginning to choose. And I clarify that because some people listening very understandably might hear this, see this, understand this, right? Maybe even know where all of their reactions connect to, yet not be able to break that patterning or not wonder why, oh, now I get it. Why isn't it going away? Right? So it's a gradual evolution to make the space and then to stand into the space all of the while you're still feeling like you want to scream or yell or, you know, do the old thing. So a great, you know, first and foremost, we all have to, I believe at least there is a point of no return. You know, if we want to have an emotional 1 to 10 scale, once I'm at that 8 or 9, you know, it's a slippery slope and I still do it. I can still watch myself and be like, ooh, girl, you should not send this text that you're going to send right now. And I'm like, ping, and off it goes, you know, because I've already, you know, decided that I've lost control and I'm at the 9 or 10. So what I mean when I say that is learn your markers, you know, yourself, start to learn your body and how it starts to tell you it's getting activated because it will, right? Of course, though, this goes all back full circle. We need to learn how to be connected with our bodies before we can learn our body's markers. So again, process, but learning that. So I can feel tension, right? I can feel myself starting to stir as I amp up, you know, toward that old reaction, because the sooner I can make a new choice, you know, the more I can prepare or equip myself to be able to actualize that choice, to not go past that point of no return. Another thing you're going to hear me talk a lot about is harnessing the power of our breath and a breath work practice, because you said a really important word early on when we were talking about something else, Andy, with children and their social emotional security. Those of us who have lived any version of trauma, big T, little T, some of us are living in a hyperactive nervous system. Our nervous system is responding to as if we are chronically under that same stress. We are always activated. We are always kind of primed for that other shoe to drop. So breath work, I mean, breathing is something we do all day long anyway. There's a way that we can consciously harness the power of our breath by cultivating the simplest one that I'm always talking about is a deep belly breath. So, which is much more challenging than it sounds if anyone's ever tried it. But learning how to just really breathe deep into that belly and learning how to really elongate our out breath. Why we care about that breath is because it helps tone our nervous system. If you're someone like me, so right, this is how this comes full circle. My always something mentality led to a chronically overwhelmed nervous system. I was chronically activated in fight or flight. It was no shock that when I was, like I said, 20s living in New York, I was at that 9 or 10 all the time. No shock that I was in a constant panic attack. My nervous system never turned off. So if you're like me, cultivating an intentional way to breathe can start to help us regulate our nervous system, help us instill that safety and that security that is ever necessary for all of us humans so that we can regulate ourselves in that moment. So learning our cues so that I can intervene, and a great intervention is breathing, is focusing our attention, giving myself a breath or two as I feel my body start to amplify or dysregulate. That might be enough to bring it down, to give me that space to then sometimes end the conversation, right? To say, you know what, this isn't going to be resolved right now. Or, you know what, Johnny, I you know, teacher does need a moment to go, you know, we'll have this conversation at 3 o'clock after school, right? When I'm calmer, and then I can deliver a new response. So it's about knowing ourselves, knowing, right, our points of escalation, and then learning how to build in tools that we can regulate ourselves in those moments when we really need to.
Yeah, and that's an incredible skill to teach young people, and the physiology of the breath, the power of the breath, and that it's not just fluffy. You used to hear years ago, oh, just take a deep breath.
No,
it's just not for me. No, I can't do that. Well, if people actually understood the physiology of the breath and the fact that it can pull you from the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system, and it reduces cortisol, and what are some of the other neurotransmitters or neurochemicals that are spiked when we're stressed? It's adrenaline, cortisol.
Right.
So the physiology of the breath, it reduces those things to allow you to create the space to not react. Right.
Absolutely.
So I've heard that through this intentional breath work that the exhale should be longer than the inhale. Is there truth to that? And can you talk more about the physiology of the breath and why it's so important to teach people?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to acknowledge that I think we're setting ourselves up to proclaim it doesn't work for me, because a lot of us are trying to only use it in those as needed moments. And I'll let you know right now, it won't work, right? If you're like, oh, okay, the breath work, one deep breath, and you wait until you're at that 8 or 9 with your partner, and maybe you do one deep breath, chances are that one deep breath at that moment isn't going to be the difference, right? So it's really about, and I say this with all things, practicing consistently, the word that we all love to hate, right? All the time, so that I can balance my nerve, because we're not just overactivated in those moments, most of us. We're overactivated all the time. So it's really about going back to that more kind of homeostatic state of balance as a whole, and also to then use it. But if we're just going to try to deploy these tools in those moments, you know, if we even remember that we want to do this new thing, which chances are we're not going to, we're probably not going to be able to do it as successfully. So those people that have tried one deep breath here and there aren't wrong. It doesn't work. It doesn't work like that. That's not how this works. So the breath that we want to cultivate is breathing deep from that belly region. And again, much more difficult, I think, that's done than just kind of, oh yeah, I just breathe from my belly. Most of us, by the time we become an adult, breathe really shallow from our chest, which that type of breathing, I know I used to breathe like that, sends a signal itself to the nervous system that there is a threat. That shallow based breathing is one of the markers of being in that activation. For me, my posture wasn't great, still isn't. I carry my emotions in shoulder tension and slightly, you know, so for me, learning a belly breath, I had to lay down. So that's the breath we want to cultivate. And yeah, if we can, there's all these different type of breath works. I mean, if you Google breath work, there's 4-7-8 breath, there's box breathing, there's breath of fire. So by all means, find the breath work that I particularly like. Wim Hof. I do Wim Hof breath work in the morning. So not all one type. I just like to talk about the practical type. So I don't have to be sitting, you know, my breath work looks a little crazy. People might wonder if I'm hyperventilating when I do it. So if I can just do the belly breathing throughout my day, and then with that said, elongate a little bit, that's enough to begin to stimulate that parasympathetic. It doesn't have to look like a whole structured practice. And I offer, especially if that feels overwhelming to you, not to set that as the intention. Don't decide you're going to go do 20 minutes of breath work every day. One new thing is hard. That's probably going to be not attainable or maintainable for you. So if you're listening, if you're new to this, if you think it could be helpful, your small daily promise, that's what I talk about when I talk about incorporating change, might be just throughout your day, one time, focus on where your attention is when you're breathing and try to breathe from that belly. And then over time, maybe try to elongate that breath. I try to resist giving like 4-point to-do lists and these big, overwhelming new things to do, because I know how overwhelming that can be to our subconscious, who prefers that we keep living that Groundhog's Day, that we keep living that day in and day out pattern, because it knows what to expect. that's when we become at odds, because there's a very big part of ourselves that for a lot of us knows that we want more, we want different, yet we remain stuck.
Yeah. My wife does a lot of mindfulness. She's a mindfulness instructor and she works at the school, and she took over morning announcements, and she decided the person who did morning announcements before would tell jokes and stuff. It was great, but she thought she would incorporate some mindfulness. So she does a daily mindful breath every morning. And then she has kids coming up to her in the hallway asking her to teach more breaths, or sometimes she will get them to lead the breath in the morning announcements. So it's a part of the culture of the school. And to create these changes, we can't have these happening in silos. It has to be a part of the culture of the organization, right? And I want to dive into, with the remaining time, to, you know, you talk about emotional dysregulation a lot, right? So can you just talk about, first of all, what that is, and then how emotional dysregulation is manifested?
Yeah, absolutely.
So people really understand it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the way I think about and define, you know, regulation, dysregulation in terms of emotions goes back to a concept of stress as we study it. Right. So stress, and, you know, in stress, you know, I throw negative emotions, like difficult things, like stressors, as we think about them. So we are equipped, wired, evolutionarily wired, to not only tolerate, but to benefit from some degree of, you know, kind of start, beginning, and end of a stressful event, right? So to put it simple, we need stress. It's called EU stress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S, right? It's good. It helps us grow. It helps us evolve. You know, it's scaffolding is a very akin principle that I know have been learning. I learned to be, you know, scaffolding, where you stress the child, you know, a little bit outside of their abilities, and you're kind of there. That's how we grow, right, as humans. So I say that to say, we are equipped to have something stressful happen to us, to deal with it, including our nervous system activates, you know, in the appropriate direction needs to activate, right? We feel all the discomfort, and then we return to a baseline. Right. So that, I just want to clarify, stress, not bad. We need stress. Mm-hmm. We don't, you know, and I say this also to parents very well intentionally, parents, educators. I think sometimes what we do is we want to overcompensate. We live something difficult, so we want to put our kids in a bubble, in a sense, and not give them anything to stress about. I don't think that's the appropriate direction either, because like I said, stress, helpful, helps us grow, helps us learn resilience, how to deal with the hard things in life. Right. So we need to learn how to kind of come back from that. And that's where dysregulation occurs, when we don't kind of return to that baseline, either because the stress was way too overwhelming, you know, and no one helped us, or it was way too chronic. So I fell in that a little bit of both, you know. I'm sure overwhelming things happen contextually, and that always something, there was never an off to my stress. So my body didn't have a sense, and I didn't have the model or the caretaker to help me return to that baseline. And there's a lot of pathways that we fall into that dysregulation, but that's what simply it is, where we don't process the stress and go back to a baseline.
What would teachers see in their students if they were emotionally dysregulated?
A lot of times, so the kind of high, where it feels like the emotions are right below the surface, you know, kind of like all the straw, like the kid who is hyper vigilant. A lot of times it'll look like they're always on, they're waiting for the next shoe to drop. They may actually startle responses. Right. That's going to be a signal of being in that overactive sympathetic state. There's also an overactive parasympathetic state. That would be the child who has no energy, is listless, is just kind of, you know, barely there, low mood a lot, you know, not really playing. Now, again, this isn't in a vacuum, right? I'm not saying this child maybe suffered a loss at home, you know, contextually, that kind of mood, it's consistency. Is the child always, you know, never seeming like they have any energy? Are they maybe locked in that parasympathetic state? Or maybe they're on the other end of the spectrum. Are they always, like, are they the startled child, the jump, you know, jump swing? I remember I tell this story a lot, because this is really embodies this, and it's a little sad, but I really had a hard time with hide and seek when I was a child, because when I was hiding, because I was always waiting for that next shoe to drop, I would be so worried that the seeker was going to scare me, because I was already on edge waiting to be scared. I was living in fear that I would jump out when they, I was a great hider, but I would give myself away when they would come into the room because I was that child. For me, I mean, that sounds like crazy that, oh, you know, my little friend coming into the room to find me, but that would have been enough to send me into that startle response. So it could look like that. It also could look like, right, the child who's an endless emotional breakdown and can't return to that state, right? Where one emotion just snowballs and now all day, all week, right? The child is whatever emotion it is. It could be anger, it could be sadness, right? Where we don't, there's not that bounce back. Again, this is not contextually where something's going on at home that we're aware of and it'll go away in time. This is that chronic when we're stuck or when we observe this consistently in a child.
So we're talking, oftentimes teachers talk about the student who's always on alert and how to pull them back. But then, like you said, I've never heard of the overactive parasympathetic nervous system in students. So I like the way you describe that. So what is the goal of a teacher who has a student like that? Do you want to kind of pull them to a more balanced state? And how might you do that? Just by encouraging and knowing them?
That person will want help being activated. Mm-hmm. And again, this is very individualized.
Right.
And,
yeah.
We want to have established trust and knowledge of the student to help scaffold them and push them. So for some, it could be physical movement, energetic, you know, a connection, you know, sometimes for that person, you know, connecting with even another human feels activating. So it could even just be you having a, you know, kind of a personal attentive exchange with that person. It's baby steps, right? It's about, there's a great book, I forget that it's called Window of Tolerance or something like that. But it talks about the same model, right? We're not going to, you know, kind of inundate a child who, you know, and go and run them around and shake them and do something. We want a baby step. We want to expand their, what's called the window of tolerance gradually so that they can then establish safety in this new unfamiliar state. Cause that's what it's going to be for the child at first, whatever direction you're working toward, it's going to feel unfamiliar, not like they're used to feeling, which is uncomfortable and can be destabilizing. So that's where the connection, the bond can be really incredibly beneficial because you can cultivate the safety and the security within the relationship. So even if the child is a bit dysregulated because they're in a new unfamiliar state, they can feel safe and secure that they're there with another adult who can help them regulate.
Which requires the adult, again, being present and attuned. You know, so if they're unable to do that, they'll never see those signs and they'll never be able to jump in the way that they want to jump in. They have the best of intentions and glimpse in moments they'll do it, but consistency requires, you know, much more awareness. I want to jump in the last few minutes to, you know, I know you have such a wealth of knowledge on your website, which is theholisticpsychologist.com, right?
The website is Your Holistic Psychologist.
Oh, Your Holistic Psychologist. So that'll be in the show notes. But can you just describe, if you could recommend, you have a lot of great videos, but if you could recommend a few of the videos that educators might benefit from watching, which ones would you recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm always, anything I do, I'm talking about consciousness. That's a great, great first step because that's the foundation. And then I talk about one video that just came to mind. I put them out every Sunday. I have a YouTube channel, The Holistic Psychologist. I actually just did one. It was in honor of all things COVID and quarantine, but definitely applies to children as well. How to support someone, how to hold space, because a lot of times going back to the little T trauma that you and I kind of referenced earlier, a lot of times children are invalidated in their feelings in particular, you know, by adults very, you know, not even thinking, very unconsciously sometimes, right? Telling them, you know, not to feel a certain way or that their feelings aren't valid because the adult wouldn't feel that way in this particular situation. So I think a lot of us can be helped by learning how to hold space or, you know, offer support, especially with children, right? Because you might not understand exactly why whatever event you might have even witnessed happening, you know, right, with little Janet over here and you see, you know, but that wouldn't have affected you like that. So you might find yourself challenged to honor that Janet, for whatever reason, is that upset in this moment. And that's what it's about, holding space for how Janet feels, instead of saying, oh, Janet's not the time, or that didn't really happen, or he didn't mean that, or it's okay, it's class time over here now, right? Just honoring Janet's feeling. So a video that comes to mind is how to support someone, you know, anything I'm talking about emotions and really just how to tune and regulate our emotions can go a long way. So
right. I saw the four stages of awakening of the ego, which is a great, it's a 5-minute video, but very clear. And you know, you go through the stages and you emphasize it's not linear, you know, but lots of insight in such a short video. Can you tell people before we close about Self-Healers Circle?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's my newest passion project. I guess it was in November, we launched the first enrollment. So the Self-Healer Circle is a online virtual community where we have self-healers from around the world at this point. So very similar to your amazing community, who get together and do some healing. So every month there's a new topic on the healing journey that we cover, where we have myself and other experts come in and do an hour-long workshop. Every month there's a live question and answer where I'll take, you know, in the moment questions of healing around that topic, guided meditations, all sorts of journaling prompts and tools, obviously tools, worksheets, how to engage the topic. So it's really my passion project because it's a way that we can connect with each other, people that are in different stages of the journey. I mean, we have people just beginning, we have people that have been on the journey for quite some time. Just a time and a space for us to connect together around the work, doing the work. For me, what brought me online about, gosh, a year and a half-ish ago now, onto that Instagram was looking for this community because I didn't have it. I was starting to notice and see a lot of my own personal relationships shifting and changing, and I was feeling really lonely. You'll hear me talk about loneliness a lot in awakening, and you know, I was shifting the way I practiced. So, you know, I wasn't sure how my peers in my field. So the short of it is I created a community that I've been looking for individuals to heal that have the same language and that understand the same things. And we might be in different stages of our journey, but where we can show up and support each other. So it's been amazing. The growth, the change, the connections, you know, that I'm seeing happening, that I'm a part of, is incredible. We just opened up enrollment again, May 1st, I guess it was. So it's closed now until the fall. We typically open it twice a year, a fall and a spring. So anyone who's interested, through my Instagram is where all of the messaging comes out. So I have a link tree up and you can check out the website for the Self-Healer Circle, if something you're interested in. It's really cool. In the future, we're expanding it a bit and hopefully going to develop a really cool new addition to it. So it's really my passion of supporting holistic healing in all of the corners of the world.
Yeah. And, you know, so important for educators who want to, you know, learn more about that. They can find it on your website. Can they find self-heals?
So they can find, so if you go to the Instagram, you'll see a link tree and one of the links will be there. And absolutely, yeah. So any educators out there, I have a lot of practitioners of all sorts that are in the group. And I always say the same thing, whether it's my Instagram or the Self-Healer Circle, I'm not proprietary over the material. I actually have a lot of practitioners that I know are using, you know, materials that come through the circle in their own practices. So same goes for educators. You know, I'm honored to see and hear if, you know, you guys are in the circle already and using some of these tools with your students. I wholeheartedly welcome it. Yeah. So that's a big part of it, is making sure that these tools get into the hands of people who could use them.
Yeah, great. And to close off, Nicole, what has inspired you since the beginning of the public health crisis? What has kind of kept your fire lit? Obviously your work and your passion, but can you just talk about what's really inspired you over the past few weeks?
Absolutely. I think the connections, I mean, whether or not it's just people, you know, reaching out because they have time and space in their worlds to, you know, just jump on a call or do create something together professionally or just support each other, you know, just humanity, the collective coming together, I think in all of the ways that it is incredibly inspiring. It's continued to inspire me to create through this whole, you know, through everything that's going on. So just all the different opportunities that I'm seeing people taking and carving out to connect with other people, even if it's in a not as traditional way as we used to, we're getting creative. And I think it's inspiring.
Great, great. Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm going to close off the show, and you can just stay on for 30 seconds. I just want to say goodbye to you, but I'm going to put all your information in the show notes, and I really hope educators listening to this will access your work in order to learn more and just become better at what they do personally and professionally. So everybody, thank you for listening to this episode with Dr. Nicole LaPera, and I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.
Yes, thank you so much.